Thoroughbred Tales, taking you behind the scenes of the international horse racing and breeding industry.
Welcome to another episode of the Thoroughbred Tales podcast. And this week we're talking to our current guest host, Harry Eustace, who recently set up training in Newmarket after taking over from his father, James Eustace. Harry, welcome to the Thoroughbred Tales podcast and thank you for hosting us this week.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
How has the week been so far? Have you enjoyed hosting it? Has it been an enjoyable experience?
It's been good, actually. I mean, it's something obviously I've never really had to do before. And so I asked a few friends and outside of racing what to do. And they were like, you forget that the mundane stuff for you is interesting for people that never do it. So we tried to sort of not keep it simple, but show stuff that we take for granted, I suppose. It helped that the weather was fantastic because it always looks better in the sun. So
one of the things that I've liked the most that you did this week, that's something that no other host in the year and a half that we've been doing it has thought of, is to explain what the board is and how it works and how you use it in your day-to-day routine, which is something that those of us who are in yards regularly and ride out could take completely for granted. But there was great interest from our followers about your explanation of that.
Yeah, well, that was actually a very good friend and owner of mine, Martin Mitchell, has a group of younger lads, predominantly based in London, in a horse with me and Charlie Fellows, and I actually did a similar one for them. I was doing the board one time and he was there doing it and he was interested and he was like, you know, the boys would be fascinated by this stuff because you forget, like most owners, they're intelligent people and they are interested in stuff like that. But you just think that the lingo and how it works is sort of, because they don't understand it, they'll never understand it. But actually, if you give them the chance to see it, especially via video, I think that helps. And they enjoyed it. So I thought, well, if they did, then others might. So we gave it a go, yeah.
Something that somebody once said to me, which I thought was interesting, that instead of dumbing down racing and making it really easy for people to understand, actually, a lot of people get into racing because they want to learn something new. They want to learn new lingo and add some more knowledge to their kind of base of that they have already. And I think that's something, I'm not sure if you found that with your owners from outside of racing, but it's something that we're finding with Thoroughbred Tales as well, is that people don't want it to be made really easy for them to understand. They just want that opportunity to learn more.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the vocabulary we use is unique and people like that. It's like, it's happening at the moment in cricket. They're doing something called the 100 and they're trying to change the name for sort of certain parts of the game. And actually, I think they're missing the point because they think they'll reach a wider audience. And I'm not sure that works. I think the point of each sport and their sort of individual components of it are that there are parts that use vocab and lingo and phrases and sayings that don't translate to other sports. And that's what makes it unique. And that's what people enjoy the most, actually. And I think that's what Thoroughbred Tales is trying to do, is actually educate. Like, let's educate people to our level rather than try and dumb it down from our point of view, because nobody wins by trying to make things simpler in that respect, I don't think.
No, it's been a really enjoyable week and we've all loved seeing your dad doing his bit of DIY in his shorts. How's his back after his accident?
No, he's made a remarkable recovery, but it is a bit of an ongoing joke that if you ever see him walk out with a toolbox, you're like, oh, blimey, what's he doing now? And I was just walking across the yard and I saw him sort of Panama shorts and toolbox. And I was like, I've got to start. I've got to say something about this. It's too good to be true. So I'm glad everyone enjoyed it because I know Mum and I certainly did and my brother. I don't know how much Dad did, but he's used to it. So
how is he enjoying his retirement in inverted commas, though? He looks to be keeping busy.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you'd have to ask him, but I think he's still out every morning, all lots, and he helps out wherever he can, but he's enjoying having the flexibility of being able to do other things. Sort of just in his example, we had a couple of runners at two different tracks the other day, and one was at Brighton. It was Coverham, who is an old sort of syndicate horse of his and a bit of a legend. And even more importantly, my first ever winner, which was fantastic. And So he went down to Brighton to saddle him because I went elsewhere. I can't remember where I went now. But we have family down in Sussex Way. So ordinarily he'd have gone to Brighton, saddled the runner and driven home. But he stayed down the night, stayed with family, made a bit of a trip of it. And it's that sort of opportunity that I think he's enjoying the most of, rather than having that sort of absolute dependency of always having to be back. And it's great for me that he still wants to be involved. You know, I mean, he's another set of eyes and he's got more experience than I have. And it's just great having a sounding board like that constantly there. You know, he's always thinking for you. It's a team sport, so.
It's hard for any young trainer starting out, especially these days. It's getting harder and harder all the time. It must be, you saying having him there as a sounding board, it must be a great kind of safety net, nearly, having him there to give you, to be able to have handed over the reins like that and still be there and it not be, you know, starting from absolute scratch.
It was the most single biggest bonus of my situation was I was handed the reins of a business that, a financially successful business that was rolling, and therefore there was no like startup mistakes, there was no like learning on the job beginning wise, because those basic systems were in place: feed orders, bedding orders, what you use, you know, the invoicing, all that sort of stuff, the books, who does the wages, like all that sort of stuff is already in with a lot of people that have a lot of knowledge about it. And it meant that financially, one, I didn't have that initial burden. And two, I could concentrate rather than worrying about things that were having to be rectified or fixed or whatever, because it was starting out and we'd made a mistake at the start sort of thing. So it made a huge difference and still does, frankly. You know, it's to start off like that, the not having a financial pressure like that is huge. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, we know that you, from your introduction on Thurber Tales at the start of the week, that you spent some time with William Haggis and with Christoph Clement, but tell us a little bit about your path into the industry.
Yeah, so I was very fortunate. I was obviously taken over from Dad, who has trained at Park Lodge for 32 years. So I grew up at Park Lodge all my life, which, you know, is a huge plus for me. It meant that, you know, when you grow up in an industry like this, it's always there and there's always opportunities for you. I still went to school, and then I went to uni with the sort of idea that having a degree is a backup in case training didn't work, but sort of halfway through quickly realized that that really wasn't the sort of mentality that I'm used to, and that I should just act like training was always going to work. So I dropped out halfway through, rightly or wrongly. It depends who you ask, but it was still a great time. I met a lot of friends not in the industry, which I think is quite important. Sometimes it'd be quite all-encompassing and a bit sort of, and can get quite intense, and it's nice having those friends outside of racing that don't understand what you're talking about, don't really want to talk about horses, and it's quite refreshing to get away from it. So I was conscious that if I left uni but stayed in England, I would probably spend a lot of time with them still. So I through John Ferguson sorted out a job down in Australia, and that was the start of what has felt quite a long apprenticeship, I suppose, which was fantastic. And saw sort of both sides. So Lee Freeman and Anthony Freeman at the time, they're at Markdale, so I owned sort of private training centre and got that sort of experience, which was interesting. And then moved to Flemington to Peter Snowden's Melbourne stables, then worked on track. And while I was down there, applied to the Irish National Stud course, and got on. So that's where I went, you know, off the back of us.
The Irish National Stud course, we saw from when they were hosting the other week, it's been a great grounding for so many people throughout the industry. And I'm sure you learned plenty from your time on their course.
It was fantastic for me because I've only grown up with the thoroughbred racing side, not the breeding side. So everything was every day I learned something, because teasing mares and cycling and checking bags and all that stuff was brand new to me. And for a lot of people on the course, it was a bit repetitive, but actually for me, I I found it fascinating, and dealing with foals and stallions and yearling preps, and you know, the whole lot is new, and more importantly, it also gives me an idea of the other side of the fence. So either the owner breeders or the consigners or the pinhookers, having had done a bit of it, I can at least understand where they're coming from. Whereas if I hadn't, I'd not be ignorant about it, but I wouldn't know. So it's hard for me to relate to what they would be talking about and the problems that they can be dealing with.
Yeah, one of the things we have seen through Thoroughbred Tales is the amount of different people in different areas of the industry that I think a lot of the average racing fans are ignorant of as well, is just how many people are relying on the success of that one horse, you know, from the people who own the mare and bred the foal and need it for the future progeny, and all the other people involved along the way. It's a long chain to get that horse to the...
Yeah, there are a lot more cogs in the whole machine than it sort of first appears, I think. And racing in particular is the face of the industry. So people understand where trainers fit in, where jockeys fit in, where owners fit in, and more where the staff fit in. I think ITV, for instance, do a great job telling everybody who looks after the winners and trying to sort of personalize the fact that individuals do look after these horses. But behind that face of it is a huge, huge industry. And the breeding side of that is that, really. It gets very little coverage. And like we were talking about dumbing down, that is something I'd switch, actually. And I think if people started to learn that the reason they're watching the racing is because we want the best to win, and the reason we want the best to win is because we want to try and breed better racehorses, and that if they start knowing the horses that are winning at the races and then we start talking about them at stud, they'll start to like understand the flow of what it, and the bigger picture of the whole thing. And it's difficult, I'm sure, because time is precious on something like that too, but I think we need to sort of try and educate that side of it more, definitely.
It's fascinating in normal pre-COVID and hopefully soon times, when if you go to like Newmarket for the December sales, especially with flat racing, because there's a much quicker turnover than jump racing, but it's fascinating to go and look through a catalogue and see horses that you were watching on the track not that long before. Yeah. Suddenly you're seeing them go through the sales ring, and the progeny of the sires and the dams go through the ring. And once you get into it and you start following and looking for things throughout the same family, it becomes really interesting. And I think if more people saw that side of it, they'd realize why breeding can be so addictive and interesting.
And either family traits, either from the mare side or the stallion side, like ground conditions. And, you know, you start to pick that up if it's talked about and you understanding it. And, you know, so I don't know what an obvious one is, maybe sort of pivotals and soft ground or something like that, you know, but as a vague one. But like that sort of thing is interesting if people are allowed the sort of opportunity to know about it. Yeah.
And so from the Irish National Stud Course, where did your career take you after that?
So the only not problem with it, but it's a 6-month course, so it finished in sort of June, July, which is slap bang in the middle of the flat season, which sort of typically quite difficult to then find a pupil assistant or assistant role. I got lucky, and Chris Wall needed a pupil assistant / assistant for 6 months until somebody was due to start. So I worked for him for 6 months, which was fantastic. And it was at the time when he had horses like Raw Rock and Premier Loco, and he had some decent horses, and they were fun to be around. And we went to sort of the bigger meetings, and they ran in proper races, and it was a fun time, actually. And then from there, I went and worked for Jeremy Nazida for 2 years, which was very interesting. It's one of those, you're always trying to step up the ladder. And so slightly bigger yard, the quality was arguably a bit higher from the sales. It doesn't necessarily mean they're better racehorses, but you're trying to improve all the time, aren't you, on the horses that you're dealing with. And I learned a huge amount there. Very interesting trainer, very good trainer. And I was lucky, Dad worked in America. And so America was always on the map too, to go to. And so I was nearing the end of my time with Jeremy, and they emailed Christophe Clement, because they'd worked together in Newmarket when Christophe had worked for Luca. And saying, you know, where should he go? Should he go East Coast or West Coast? And he just replied saying, I'll give him a job let me know when he wants to start, which was the easiest job interview I've ever had to do. I'd never spoke to him. And went out there, started out in Payson Park in Florida, and went from there. I was there about 2.5 years and I absolutely loved it. And America is definitely one of those places where, unless you've worked there and you understand their racing, people will be very iffy about American racing and they'll jump to an opinion on it. And partly quite rightly, because they're certainly at the moment, they're not exactly covering themselves in glory, but it is unique. It's a very different type of racing. And until you've worked in it and begin to understand dirt racing and the breeding and all that sort of stuff, it appears foreign even to, you know, people in racing in this jurisdiction. And so you can get labeled quite quickly, but I had a fantastic time out there. And it was where I got my first real responsibility. Christoph was very, very good to me. And I basically worked with him for a year and then looked after a string of horses for him, mainly in Kentucky. But we moved around a little bit for the sales. So that was brilliant, brilliant time.
And eventually you ended up back home, back in Newmarket, but with William Haggis, where you spent the last while.
Yeah, so while I was out working for Christoph, I'd emailed William saying, you're probably not looking at the moment, but when you are looking, I would like to be considered, basically. And I sort of tried to not jump the gun, but I tried to get my name at the top of the list. You know, there were a few trainers that, a few obvious choices that I wanted to work for. He was one of them, and timing wise, it worked out well. I started the week after Ascot, and I think I was there 4.5 seasons. And it was absolutely fantastic. And we went from strength to strength. And the horses that I was around were, you know, they're absolutely some of the best. And I was incredibly lucky. It's a incredibly impressive, professionally run outfit. And I think everyone can see that, one, with the results, but just the way all the horses are presented, the way the boss presents the whole show is just pure professionalism. And it was an absolute dream to work there, frankly.
I know William is a highly respected trainer and a top trainer and a gentleman as well. But has he been encouraging and supportive of you since you've gone out on your own? Is he another ear that you can kind of rely on when you need to talk?
Most definitely. You know, if ever there's, you know, someone I need to talk to about work or non-work related, frankly. I mean, when you work for someone for that period of time so closely, the point of having an assistant is that you start to understand how they like things done, and so you start thinking like them, which means you do get this rapport and understanding by the time you've finished, but sort of early on. And I can definitely go and talk to him anytime. He'd always be there, and he's always asking how things are, and I think he's not watching my runners, but he definitely is, I think, because I sort of start to tell them about them and he's like, no, I already know, and that sort of stuff. Usually the losers. But I had a grumble about the handicapper the other day and he said, you sound like every other trainer. So that was nice, I suppose.
That's a compliment coming from William.
Yeah, exactly.
You've said that, like, growing up in the industry opened a lot of doors for you, and clearly it's made it easier for you to get jobs with some of these trainers. But were you also very conscious of getting all of this experience? Because you've had a vast wealth of experience before you set up training. Were you conscious of not just working for your dad straight out of university and then taking over the reins, but gathering as much experience around the world as possible?
Horse racing is a global international sport, and the skills we've got are very transferable, and you can go anywhere in the world if you want. So why wouldn't you? I mean, why would you not get on a plane and go and see as much of it as possible? There would be no point me leaving uni and going to work for my dad, because I'd bring nothing new. The point is to always try and be thinking, not outside the box, but trying to improve everything you're doing, like question everything that you're doing. And you can't do that if you hadn't had experience outside of the one place you're working at. And I mean, I loved traveling too, so I was never not going to travel. And you know, I could easily have worked in other countries too, but with the beauty of home was having Park Lodge and dad and the start that I would have. I mean, the more experience, the better. I felt very consciously that I had to, not very consciously, but I also wanted to prove that I had done the work to get to the point and to justify being a trainer. I felt that quite strongly. So I was always going to put in a shift.
Earn your place at the table.
Yeah.
And the reverse is true as well, because your brother David is having great success since he's gone down to Australia and linked up with Kieran Maher in their training partnership.
Yeah, so he worked for Roger before Berrien and took a couple of horses down to Oz. And while he was down there, initially sorted out a job with Peter Moody. He was then sent to Sydney. He worked for Peter Snowden. So we actually both worked for Peter Snowden. And then he wanted to go back to Melbourne. So, and at the same time, Kieran picked up a load of horses and boxes from Peter Moody because he was retiring. And it was, the timing was just right for them. And Australia is you know, everyone bangs on about Australia, but it's young and it's vibrant and it's very strong at the moment. And the beauty for us is they're not like, we have a lot of traditions, which is excellent, but it can bog you down in detail that is slightly irrelevant, but it's just something racing's always done. And part of it is its image. And I get that, but Oz doesn't have that. And so they don't get bogged down in certain details like we do. And, you know, for example, syndicating and joint licenses and things like that are very natural to them and a very obvious thing to do. And so he then got on the license with Kieran. I think it must be about a year and a half now. And, you know, again, they've just gone from strength to strength. And they're a huge example of how you can train numbers of horses well. You know, they do operate at a huge number of horses, and yet, you know, their results speak for themselves, and at both numbers and quality, and it's been great to follow, really. And I know, I mean, mum and dad are, my brother sometimes says that he knows they've had a, you know, say they've got plenty of runners on a day and he's entertaining owners, and he'll know they've had a winner because mum and dad follow them closer than he do sometimes, and the phone will ping and the family WhatsApp will go and it'll be, well done, another winner or something like that, and he'll know something's won somewhere and he'll have to track down the result down the line. So and this is sort of 4 o'clock in the morning, though. I can just picture them, the light will go on, the iPad will come out, they'll watch the race and then they'll put it back down and they'll go back to sleep. I mean, they're avid followers of the Australian racing.
They must be loving having you both training now and having that involvement and that another generation of Eustaces with trainers licenses.
I think so, and I think they've worked incredibly hard to provide an opportunity for one of us, or both of us, but you know, to see, I think certainly Park Lodge carry on was huge for them, dad in particular, but for both of them. You know, they've sacrificed a huge amount for both of us over the last 30 odd years, and to see it come to fruition, I think I hope is making them very proud. And they never, not that they never say it, but they wouldn't sort of stroke our egos too much, but I think they are really enjoying the fact that we're both training, and thank God I've trained a couple of winners and Big's trained a couple of hundred, so
And how are you enjoying it? How has it been the start of your training career?
I've thankfully started better than you could dream, hope, really, and have had sort of a few winners on the board early enough on. And now it's just a matter of, you know, continuing that and trying to find, you know, the sort of the animals and the material to keep having winners. Again, Haggis's was very professionally run, attention to detail and at times quite intense, and not that they realize it, but it was the perfect way to start, because it actually didn't feel any different for me when I started training. You sort of make plenty of important decisions all the time in a job like that, and therefore you gave it as much thought and care as I do now. And so from that respect, it wasn't daunting. I said it a lot, but just getting the first winner out the way, more to prove to myself than anybody that that you can actually train a racehorse, was very relieving, I have to say.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty more to come where that one came from. But Harry, thank you again for hosting us this week. We really enjoyed seeing around your yard. I hope lots of people have enjoyed it too, and I hope you've got something from the experience as well. But thank you once again.
Thanks very much. Been a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the Thoroughbred Tales podcast. Join us next week when we'll be talking to another guest host about their very own Thoroughbred Tale.
Thoroughbred Tales, taking you behind the scenes of the international horse racing and breeding industry.